The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. This is a very special edition, in fact, one of our first special editions. I'm not sure what we're calling it, but let's call it an appendix. I'm Tom Butler, as usual, joined by Brendan and Tom.
Hello.
And by a very special guest, Mr. Mark O'Connell.
Hello, guys. Hello.
Welcome.
How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
We're very well.
Very good.
Good, good.
So this special, we are revisiting an episode that we covered earlier in the run, and it's A View to a Kill. And Mark, we wanted to invite you on because we know you're a big fan of that film. But why don't you just give us a quick introduction to yourself, and then we can dive into A View to a Kill.
Absolutely. We will dance into that fire. Well, my name's Mark O'Connell, writer, author, Bond fan. I wrote Catching Bullets, memoirs of Bond fan. I do a lot of Bond commentary for all sorts of places, like the very beautiful Yahoo movies. I've done other stuff as well. I sort of call myself a pop culture pundit, or pirate, actually, which is the news that people love to try and say live on air, but that's who I am.
The pop pundit pirate. I like that.
Yes, pop culture pirate. Yeah.
Pop culture pundit pirate.
Usually good. the news team say I am not saying that, and I say I dare you, and then they always do, and it works out.
And you've got quite an interesting connection to the Bond world itself, Mark, it's fair to say.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I'm a Bond fan, like so many of us beautiful people are. But my grandfather, for many, many decades, was sort of Cubby Broccoli's driver and chauffeur and babysitter, house sitter, childminder, and he was with Cubby before Bond, so he was sort of started with him late 50s and then carried on with Cubby right up to the late 80s, actually.
Wow.
My grandfather tried to retire in the 70s, and Cubby, who was a year or two older than Jimmy, said something, I've got to tone this down a bit because it was a bit fruity broccoli language, but he said, If I can make the bloody movie, the least you can do is drive the bloody car. And it was all said in love. So my grandfather stayed on for perhaps 10 years beyond his retirement. So Bond was always in my life, in my family before I was. I remember as a kid hearing sort of names like Broccoli and Barbara and Brosnan and Roger, all these sort of names. And then it was Octopussy that was my first Bond film, but A View to Kill was the It is my favourite Bond film for lots and lots of reasons. I'm sure we'll cover some of them. But I think, as Mark Gatiss said to me once, once you become a Bond fan, it's the next one that hasn't come out yet. That is the one that often is your favourite because it's the first one that you anticipate and follow and watch. Mm. And I'm kind of there with A View to a Kill on that.
That's really interesting. I mean, that our whole idea of anticipating it, I think we were all sort of of that for the Brosnan era, and that didn't work out as well for us. I mean, you've listened to the View to a Kill episode that we did. I mean, we went really, really deep on it, and I have to say, obviously, we all love Roger Moore and his era, but I think it's fair to say we struggled with this one. Is that fair, Brendan?
Yeah, I think it was hard work. Yeah, there's so much horse stuff.
Oh, here we go, the horse stuff.
So we really struggled with it, Mark. What are we missing? What sell it to us?
You need to be 9 years old in 1985. That's a really good start. And watching Live Aid so that Duran Duran will do a really bad version. I don't know if you see it, or you need to go and look at it afterwards. When Band Aid happened, Duran Duran were in the Philadelphia American side of it. And they always say that Freddie Mercury's note, when he's doing his Radio Gaga, he gave the note that started Band Aid or Live Aid. And there's a few wags that say that Simon Le Bon gave the notes that ended it because he couldn't hit one of the high notes on A View to a Kill. You need to find it. It's like, oh, no. So, yeah, being 9 years old helps. I don't know what's wrong with you guys. I really don't. But I don't know what's not to like about A View to a Kill. I think for me personally, it underlines what happens with a lot of big franchise films, and particularly with Bond, because there's been like sort of 4,200 Bond films now. And every Bond film is someone's entry point. It's the moment they got into the films. And that does suddenly become wrapped up with nostalgia and sentiment. But why do I like A View to a Kill? I mean, you can all just go home and I'll just sit here for the next 7 hours going through minute by minute. I accept it's got flaws. Of course it has. Every film has. Every Bond film has. I like it first and foremost for my grandfather connection. So the Cub One, which is Cubby's Silver Cloud Rolls Royce, that's very much in the film, driven by Patrick Whitney. But also Patrick Whitney is wearing the same uniform my grandfather used to sometimes wear. So that's kind of nice to see. And a little touch, I don't know if anyone's clicked on this, but there's almost a chauffeur in every Bond film. And that's not some reference to my grandfather or any of Cubby's drivers. But even in Skyfall, I could be wrong, and I need to ask the right people this, but when Daniel Craig is waiting at, well, I call it Ascot Airport. It was Shanghai Airport, but filmed at Ascot. And he's pretending to be a chauffeur. I'll put money that that's my grandfather's hat that he's wearing, probably from the dusty chauffeur wardrobe. So I've got that sort of the first connection I have with it. And I nearly, so very, very nearly had the silver Rolls Royce for our wedding. And the current owner of it did try and look into getting it for us, but it turned out it would be quite dicey and expensive to pull it out of its Bond in Motion exhibition home at the time.
Pull it out of the quarry that it was sunk in.
we got married not far from Slough, so we could have maybe just borrowed it and chucked it back in the lake. I love the score. I obviously love John Barry. For such a slightly derided film, it's one of John Barry's best pieces of scoring, with that autumnal flute and string section for Wine with Stacey and Quiche with Stacey and Cats with Stacey and all of that. So I love it for that. I also just love the 80s excess of it. With Bond, you can see it particularly with the Daniel Craig films, Bond always operates 5 minutes in the future with his eye 10 minutes in the past, I often think. And A View to a Kill is like the 80s film in the way that you could say Live and Let Die or Spy Who Loved Me is the 70s Bond film. And, GoldenEye is the 90s one. I think A View to a Kill is the 80s with its yuppie excess and its white airships and that sense of America as well. America was quite key to the 80s. We were all obsessed by everything American in the 80s. So that also feeds into it. I never look at Roger Moore, sort of 57, 58, being that old. Yes, when he's compared, he's doing a lot of work with Tanya Roberts, you can see a bit of age gap. But But by that point in the films, they kind of shifted Bond into being like, well, this almost godfather to three women in a row that have daddy issues. You know, Melina Havelock, Octopussy, and Stacey Sutton. Yes, he may slightly step over the godfather boundaries with most of them in the shower scene. But I never had a problem with Roger's age when I was 9 years old. And, you know, Harrison Ford's contemplating Indiana Jones 5, aged 78, 79. I think Roger can be forgiven for letting his stunt double go to Paris and San Francisco.
I think, I think one of the things that we discussed at the time was, you're right, it has a foot in the past, but also a foot in the future. It is trying to do something. Mm. It's trying to move things forward, particularly with the casting and the song.
Mm.
And actually, the cast around Bond, we all decided, I think, is a particular highlight. I think Christopher Walken and Grace Jones is inspired casting. Patrick McNee, mm-hmm. just, you know, anything with Patrick McNee is instantly improved, right?
Yes.
You know, yeah, argument
Go on.
No, I was going to say, I think there's an argument to say almost it's probably one of the best cast Bond films, full stop.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, the whole idea of putting Grace Jones in it was quite a bold manoeuvre. Cubby Broccoli at the time and John Glenn and the whole team were very aware of just trying to get this film get a bit more noticed in different channels and different ways. And, you know, we had Octopussy, which, again, is a very almost classical Bond film. It's hot air balloons, it's steam trains, it's old colonial India, it's circuses. Yes, there's gadgets and modernness in it, but it could almost be set in a different era. And then A View to a Kill comes, and it's white goods, it's microchips, it's as I say, it's airships in America. I think that they would try. I wouldn't say they wanted to youth it up by any stretch, but I think I remember as a kid, and again, I was 9 years old, but I remember. I was seven when Octopussy came out and nine when A View to a Kill came out. But I remember it was a lot more of a contemporary vibe surrounding A View to a Kill. You know, don't knock the Duran Duran thing, not that anyone is, but that's really important. That song was seriously everywhere in the summer of 85. And Duran Duran were bigger than Bond as well at the time. If you ever see any footage of the world premiere, it's everyone screaming for Simon Le Bon, not Roger Le Bon.
Yeah, that's something we talked about, the premiere, which sounds like quite a lavish affair. And actually, what you're talking about, Roger as well being 57, again, was something that we decided that, well, actually, I don't know what the other two thought, but I never had an issue with him being too old. He seems still like, you know, he's still got the sparkle in his eye.
And for me, it's brilliant that all the Ascot stuff, when you've got, you know, it's literally the last hurrah of money, of Lois Maxwell, Robert Brown comes back. But it feels like it's, I sort of call them the Whitehall Avengers in the Daniel Craig era. And this is their first sort of incarnation. And I like that they're not trying to make it too youthful, that there's a sentiment about getting older and all of that. In this caper, you know, about microchips, it's none of it fits, but for me, a lot of it works. And also the locations as well. It's after View to a Kill, there was quite a few Bond films where, for various reasons, the locations were kind of hidden. That you had, you know, like Mexico City was doubling up as this fictional isthmus city. I can never say that with the teeth. And View to a Kill really was perhaps the last big Bond film that didn't care that it had the Eiffel Tower and the Golden Gate Bridge in, but a Bond film would not be so obvious with that now. And also 35 years later, you know, San Francisco is perhaps less glamorous than it used to be. Paris is less glamorous than it used to be because global travel is or was more of a thing.
Taking it back to Lois Maxwell, saying it's her final film, we, like, from reading into it, I don't know what insight you have, but Was there a sense that it was an amicable exit for her at this point? Because you get a sense that maybe she felt she could carry on, but they just decided not to bring her back for the next one.
So I remember at the time, Lois Maxwell was giving interviews and she said, I have this idea. And maybe she was trying to, you know, preserve her role. And also a lot of these, you know, with, whether it was Desmond Llewellyn or Robert Brown or Bernard Lee or Lois Maxwell, they often only did like a day or two. And I think it, I remember there was a story that Roger Moore sometimes, I think it was Roger Moore, I could be getting this wrong, would sometimes fluff his lines and go over so that those actors would get a day or two more because they were contracted for as long as they were there. So that was Roger sort of eking it out and with the gang. But I remember Lois Maxwell saying that she has this vision where Bond goes into Moneypenny's annex office and he's the usual scene, but Moneypenny's not there or she's a lot younger, which kind of happened in Octopussy. And then Bond pushes through the double leather doors and a chair swings round and it's Lois Maxwell, Moneypenny, now playing M. And I remember at the time she said it would be amazing, or if it was someone like Judi Dench. And I remember thinking, wow, okay. And then 10 years later, that actually happened for real. I think more because Stella Rimington was the head of MI6 at the time. And I think there was a line Lois Maxwell may have said to Cubby about, oh, well, I could be a female M. And he said, well, we've traditionally, you know, the head of MI5 has always been a man. And Lois Maxwell came back with the famous line, well, traditionally, the Prime Minister of Britain has always been a man. So... But yeah, I can understand them moving on. And have you actually seen the Thames TV's sort of live coverage of the License to Kill premiere in June 89? It is on YouTube and it's interesting. And Lois Maxwell presents and then she interviews Caroline Bliss, who's taken over the role. I'm just suggesting there's a little bit of acidic. It all turns into sort of like All About Eve or All About Moneypenny, where you can just see the slightly... nudged aside veteran is slightly sucking it in to be polite to the one that's taken over from her, or I'm just reading too much into it.
I'll watch that one tonight.
Yeah, there's a line where Caroline Bliss says, oh, I hope I do as many as you did, and she went, yes, I hope you do too, and it was like, oh ouch.
Something else that we talked about was obviously this is Roger's last film as well, last Bond film. And like obviously there was so much back and forth over Octopussy and whether he would and whether he wouldn't. But with this one, the line was that it was a very quick decision for him. And we sort of wondered whether that might have been as a result of the, you know, the whole Octopussy versus Never Say Never Again battle and sort of how he'd sort of emerged victorious from that. And that sort of gave him the confidence just to say, I'll do one more. Is that a fair reading, would you think?
Yes. I mean, Roger Moore did probably one more about three or four times. And that kind of is where Daniel Craig is now. And he's, although I don't think he'll end up doing two or three more. Yes, Octopussy won at that, you know, won at the box office duel of Bonds. I think it's worth mentioning here that Roger Moore represented seriously good box office, not just for Bond. Obviously, Bond is where it mattered for the Bond franchise. But Roger Moore was seriously famous and popular throughout the world, particularly America. And whilst the License to Kill maybe didn't hit a busy movie summer in 89 and it didn't do so well, the 80s Bond films held up. And everyone always says, oh, you know, 80s Bond and View to Kill is terrible. Well, a lot of the Bond films, and I would suggest even now, live on a quite hand-to-mouth existence. They're always checking the figures of the last film in order to move forward. It's nothing's guaranteed. Nothing's a dead cert, which I partly think is what's going to, you know, why No Time to Die has to be handled very carefully in this COVID era in terms of its release. And that's another discussion, I'm sure. But Bond, you know, a Bond film always necessitates the next one. And I think that did happen very much with Octopussy. And also they didn't, it's, you know, Bond in the mid-80s, yeah, we probably by the mid-80s, I was only nine, but there's probably a lot of press. In fact, I know there was, like Daily Express cartoons knocking how old Roger Moore was. But and that had been going on for years. And suddenly, though, Cubby and Eon and John Glenn and United Artists, MGM, they've got this dilemma of do we recast? Do we bring a new Bond in for, you know, View to a Kill? Or do we just take that gamble, bring the budget down a bit? I think that the 80s Bonds did all shrink their budgets film after film just to keep, you know, keep the studio bigwigs happy. And I think maybe it made more box office sense to go with Roger Moore than to recast. And that, you know, there were actors that were touted about. There was Finlay Light, who was an Australian actor who got mentioned. Actually, that was more 86, 87. And then we lead into the Dalton stuff. But I, as I say, Roger Moore, people liked him. Cinemas liked him. You know, cinema managers liked what he represented to their takings. So that, it just makes sound sense. And also, he worked well with Cubby and Eon. It's good sometimes just to know what you've got. You know, moving forward, we'll keep who we've got, we'll keep the team, because unknowns are very dangerous things in movie land.
Yeah, I guess they see that every time when they're looking to recast. It's that whole mystery of the new one, isn't it? And I guess they would rather just stick with the one that they know.
What I would say is that I mean, I do this, I'm sure you guys have, where you look at it, imagine A View to a Kill with Timothy Dalton. I don't think A View to a Kill, if it kept every beat and tone and location and music cue with Timothy Dalton, I don't think it would have worked. It would have been a very different film.
Listen, it barely works with Roger.
Careful.
Yes, careful.
No, so it would be sending a butterfly on a fishing wire over.
Don't make me go and fix you a Mayday drink over the East Bay of San Francisco.
Do you have a favourite scene, Mark, in A View to a Kill, or a favourite setting?
Well, I love San Francisco. I mean, I'm a big SF guy. It's kind of become our second home, and we would like to live there one day. We'll watch this space, but we'll see. I love all the San Francisco stuff because I love America in Bond movies. I don't know why. I really miss America in Bond films. I'd love to see Daniel Craig sort of mucking about in New York or Washington. So I love all the San Francisco stuff. And also, when we stay in San Francisco, we stay with a friend who was there. In fact, the apartment is the same apartment. He was there when they shot all the City Hall scenes. And he's literally sort of, I don't know, 50 meters from City Hall, and you can see it all. But favourite scene, favourite moment? Oddly, I've always liked the moment at the chateau on the sort of moat bridge. None of it makes sense. You've got all these sort of 80s women with massive hair, and then you've got all these sort of Louis the 14th waiters. But I kind of love that scene. And I actually had a violinist play Bond Meets Stacey at our wedding as we signed the documents.
Wow.
Which was a lot less tacky than it sounds, I will say. It worked very well. I always said I wanted that played at our wedding. So my cousin, who's a professional violinist, did it at Pinewood, but that's another discussion. But yeah, we got married at Pinewood, so wow. It kind of worked.
I don't know if we talked about it when we did the podcast. Did you two have favourite scenes from this film?
It's not really scenes that I've got. It's the set pieces, like the parachute jump and yeah. the half a car. You know, yeah. They're very good stunt scenes.
I think for me, the best bit is the Golden Gate Bridge stuff, just because it's the most memorable. I don't remember much about it, apart from some punching on top of Golden Gate Bridge, but I remember the scene well compared to some of the other ones. I don't remember a lot of the other kind of horse scenes and stuff throughout the film.
I don't know why it sticks with me, but I love the scene where they're in City Hall and Bond gets rumbled by Zorin and Mayday.
Mm-hmm. I can't even remember that.
I just love Christopher Walken in that scene.
Is that when he gets an office job and he's just pottering around?
Yeah, he's just working in an office for a bit.
There's a story to all of that. I don't know if you covered it or... So you've probably heard of Harvey Milk, the guy that Sean Penn won the Oscar for 10 years mm-hmm. back, for the film Milk. And Harvey Milk got shot in 1978 by a colleague of his, and two guys got shot actually, and it really cast a dark shadow over City Hall and its workers. And then so did AIDS and HIV, and that really hit San Francisco. And Dianne Feinstein, who was then one of the civic bigwigs of San Francisco, and she's now a Democrats sort of elder. I think she's almost about to retire, but she's a big famous Democrat. She was a massive Roger Moore fan, and she went to Cubby and said, look, come and film in San Francisco. We've had a bit of a bad few years. And I'm not saying this was the conversation she had, but she almost probably had the conversation. Right, so we had these two assassin, you know, two murders in City Hall, internal jobs. It was horrible. blood and gunshot everywhere. Can you please come to San Francisco and film a scene set in City Hall where one of our workers is shot dead and left a flaming building? I always wonder why they sort of invited Bond and Roger Moore in to then recreate what happened that they were trying to forget. Yeah. That's a side issue. But yes, no, I love that. I do like that scene where Zorin walks in, Christopher Walken sort of does that thing where he grabs the two guns and swaps the guns so that Bond's gun is left as evidence for the sort of the dopey sheriff of the town. And I do think, Christopher, like you say, Christopher Walken is, he's, the dialogue could be stronger, but he does so much with that character. Mm. He's really one sick puppy. And it's not aged what he does in that film. It's slightly wired and wild. And I love him for that. I love him for that.
Is there anything about View to a Kill that you would say, I'm not too keen on that, I wish they hadn't have done that?
It's reaction to this day, yes. No, Lord bless her, left this world to go and live with the Charlie's Angels in the Sky. But Tanya Roberts, I always liked her in the role, but I never perhaps sort of stood back and looked at it. And she's so much more feisty in other things she was doing at the time, and she's not given enough. And yes, she ends up sort of a bit Fay Wray. She's sort of tied.
Yeah.
She goes through all these silent movie tropes of sort of, you know, hanging off a ladder, being tied to things, flames. You know, she's kind of left like a silent era heroine in distress all the time. So maybe I would have perhaps either repointed her character or rethought the casting. I think there was an original idea of having Priscilla Presley in the role, who's a little older, but I think she was contracted to the Dallas TV show at the time and couldn't do it. And then, there were other actresses looked at. So, yeah, maybe just slightly retweak Tanya Roberts. Genuinely only the only thing I would go back and alter if I had to, but I don't have to, though. So.
Yeah. No, well, I definitely agree with that.
Have you made the pilgrimage to Amberley, Mark?
Twice. Or no, more than that. Once when I was 11, it was when you're like a kid, they say, what do you want to do on your birthday? Who can you take? One friend, where do you want to go? And I took my friend Patrick and we went to Amberley Chalk Pits. And I got a new camera, like a stills camera, but it had like only 12 images in it. And I remember sort of taking 12 pictures of Zorin mining stock, which was still there for years and decades later, and they still have it now. And then I went back 4 or 5 summers ago. It was a bit of a Bond group thing, and they knew we were coming, and they opened up the tunnel, and they got out some of the rolling stock, and we literally were kids with a sort of Zorin train set. So yes, I've been to Amberley, and I've also been to Dunsmuir House, which is Tanya Roberts' house in the film. It's also the house from Phantasm, and So I Married an Axe Murderer. And it's in Oakland, which is sort of just outside of San Francisco. And we may have been nearby in a rental car with A Morning to Kill. So I sort of said, let's just see if we can go there. And we went there, it was closed, but you were free to walk around the grounds. And it was amazing because we were the only people there. Had we gone on the day, because it's like a heritage house where you can go and have weddings and events and things. Had we gone when it was open, it would have all just been tourists and annoying people. And it hasn't changed. It seriously hasn't changed. I looked through the windows and it looked as empty inside as well. I think they recreated its emptiness. I think they filmed the stairwell was sort of a mix of actually there and also a set. So I've been there. But, and this is where I put my hand in the air, I've actually never been to Paris officially. So the idea that I've never been to Paris and I'm a big View to Kill fan makes no sense. Yes, I've been to San Francisco and all the various...
And Amberley twice.
And Amberley twice, yeah, probably 3 times. Yeah, but I haven't been to like Paris much ever. I sort of go through Paris and end up forgetting to be there when I'm there, if that makes sense.
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, it's funny you mentioned that because I've been to Paris a few times, but I've never, any time I've been, thought about going to look at the locations that they have in the film, which I'm a bit annoyed about myself for now. So I normally do point of going to view all the Bond locations.
Well, I want to drive a blue Renault taxi down those steps, doing a very sort of hello French accent, drinking red wine, because that's what all French taxi drivers do. Bless Rémy Julien, the French stunt genius that created all the stunts, particularly the 80s Bond films. He passed away a couple of weeks ago, and he did all the stunts, all the Paris stunts for A View to Kill. I had a great day driving with Ben Collins, one of the Bond stunt drivers, and he says he kind of misses the days of that inventiveness of car chases in Bond, that silliness, like your car's being chopped in half and going across buses. But yeah, we're in the Daniel Craig era, so I don't think we're going to have comedy cars just yet.
I'd love them to throw just one scene in No Time to Die, just to see what the response is like. Something ridiculous. Corkscrew jump.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, you'll just watch this space, as they say. But yeah, well, he's got the bike jump, or some stuntman has. He's got that one, slightly CGI wire assisted.
Has it got one of those whistle noises as it's...
It will now. I've got it. Imagine if they did. Imagine if they just, they pull out all the stops and the whistle stops, yes.
We've got, talking about Remy Julien, Mark, we've got a bit of a worrying trend that's been happening with the release of the podcast.
Oh.
In that we released the first episode, and it includes Michael Apted, and Michael Apted died.
Gosh.
Then we released the second episode, which has Aston Martin in it, and they closed the Bond in Motion exhibition. Then we released episode 3, and Tanya Roberts died, and that was The View to a Kill. So we're just sort of tentatively releasing them each time and just hoping that it's not connected.
well, thank you for inviting me onto your Twilight Zone, the movie podcast of luck and devilment. Yeah, that's great. Well, bye, everyone.
Listen, we've made it to the end of this week and we haven't killed Don Black, so I think that's...
No, but I'm keeping an eye on John Taylor and Simon Le Bon. Just get your jabs before you go and sing You to Kill at some gig. Yeah, well, I'm afraid, though, we're at this time in sort of life where these people, like Sean Connery died, and it's, and everyone says, oh, God's got it in for Bond. I don't think so. I think it's Bond's, God's just got it in for people that reach a certain age, sadly.
Well, as we're discovering every week, the Bond franchise reaches so many people, even just tangentially, just by the law of average, someone will die.
You're at that point now where... all of the legends that are associated with Bond are quite old now, aren't they? So every time we do any research for it, the first thing I check is, are they still alive? Just so I could use that to fuel the rest of it before I start saying anything I shouldn't.
Well, there was a point where I kept doing these Bond sort of, Instagram posts. It was RIP and RIP. I feel like the Bond sort of...
Yeah.
The seventh veil here. I'm sort of constantly like Shane Rimmer and the greats.
It's probably a sign of that people don't often associate Bond with being an old series. If you were to do a Hitchcock series, everyone's going to be dead from that, and it's not going to be surprising. But it's probably because Bond is still in front of people's mind all the time. They don't really think it's that old. But obviously it is.
Fair play on Tanya Roberts and A View to Kill for having that rather strange departure from this world that Tanya Roberts sadly had the sort of in not in sort of moment. That was very bizarre, but sadly I was thinking when Harrison Ford goes, that'll be hard. Roger Moore going was hard because I'd met him and I'd privately been told this was on the cards, which made it actually sadder. But I sort of think Harrison Ford going, that's gonna be a blow. Not that he's going anywhere yet, folks.
Yeah, you haven't got any inside knowledge there, Mark. Please don't.
Well, as long as he stops going onto Pinewood sets and Millennium Falcons with rather large metal doors that can kill you if they come down fast.
But I think it'll be flying the aeroplanes that gets in before anything else, to be honest.
Yes. because doesn't he keep rescuing people or crashing?
And he's crashed a few
waking
times.
Waking up in car crashes and like Harrison Ford's giving them the kiss of life. Like, get up! Wait.
We won't keep you much longer, Mark, but just wanted to just briefly touch on the top five thing that you've done on Yahoo recently. And what were there, any big surprises from that, from the work that you did on that?
No, it was endearing to see. So we went to, I call them Bond alumni or, Bond experts is such a moot point because there's always some wag, including today, saying, oh, who said they were experts? Well, they're not. They're Bond actors, they're Bond designers, Bond creatives, authors, etc., etc. But I was surprised how much they weren't going too classical. So there was, people like Ben Collins, who's the stunt driver on No Time to Die. He loves A View to a Kill. That's his favourite Bond film. And I was most amazed to hear that. Yes, there's always that trinity of From Russia with Love, On Her Majesty's Secret Service and Goldfinger, they're always the family favourites that always get invited to every Bond list wedding. But then we put it out to the public, and I did a very... It was quite a big straw poll, and I got confused by some of the figures, but fortunately Twitter gives you... I did loads of polls, and you can see all the statistics, and my husband's a teacher, so he was able to do all the maths and the calculations. And then suddenly GoldenEye was number one. I was like, whoa, hang on, how? I was like, oh God, this has gone really wrong. But then I thought, no, that's not at all. Because you look at the age of people online who see and vote in these things. They're the GoldenEye generation. And GoldenEye represented them. You know, I think the reason we have Bond films now is because GoldenEye hit the ground running. And then we also had those watch-alongs last year with Pierce Brosnan and Famke Janssen and everyone. So GoldenEye was kind of out there again. I was surprised to see maybe some of the bottom ones, like Spectre was the least loved film, but it's important to remember that everyone more or less voted for one film, so that meant 23 were left, you know, sat on the bench. But Spectre was perhaps the most left alone on the bench, which I thought odd. But I thought overall it was a really fair mix, and it was a fair mix of eras and actors. So I thought that was quite encouraging because Bond to me needs to move forward. I do feel there's an issue where it needs to get slightly younger fans because it hasn't got that Marvel fever. I saw View to Kill when I was 9. The idea of my 9-year-old godson seeing a Daniel Craig Bond film is a bit odd because then possibly, you know, they're very different beasts now.
And they're so few and far between, I guess.
Yes, yeah, that as well. I thought it was really interesting, and I loved, there was little quirks like Robert Darby, who's Senor Frances from License to Kill. He put License to Kill as number 3, which I thought was initially hilarious. And then I read how he defended Goldfinger, which was his number 1, and he had such great comments on it. And the saddest thing really was I had to really abridge a lot of people's comments because it was going to become like a book otherwise. What? And I've got all the, in fact, on the photos, the top 5 photos, he's got all his proper description. He writes very well. And so does Ben Collins. Ben Collins is a really good writer, even though he's a stunt driver as well. He's a very clever writer. And then I love seeing the favouritism that Yanni Tamim, who's a costume designer on Skyfall, said that Skyfall's the best Bond film ever made. I was like, okay, of course it is. And likewise, Trina Parks from Diamonds Are Forever said that. And there was a few people, I won't name names, Tom knows who one of them is, but one Bond director got scared and wouldn't do it because he didn't want to be accused of favouritism. I was like, I want you to be accused of favouritism. I said, you are such a coward, but honestly, not a problem. A few people were busy. But no, it's been a good thing. And then this photo thing sort of taken off, which has become a sort of ice bucket challenge for Bond people.
Yeah, we haven't posted ours yet, but...
Oh no, you must.
I'm still deciding on mine.
Oh, it's really the 4th and 5th are the hardest.
Well,
yeah, you're like, I don't know what to put. It's a bit like a wedding list. Or like, which cousin do we have in at number 5? And you're like, I don't know. She'll kick off, but I do like the music on that one. So,
well, we were discussing yesterday, and yeah, as you say, 4 and 5 are the most difficult. But I've there's some films I like that from the new series that I can't compare Casino Royale to, I don't know, Goldfinger or something. It's very difficult to throw both of those in, but I ended up putting GoldenEye in, which I didn't think was in my top 5, but after doing the process of elimination, it ended up being in there.
Bond is not just about classics and quality. Sometimes Bond to me is, you know, a glass of Bollinger champagne, but sometimes it's a slightly warm beer on a Friday, you know. And that's what's great about it, and very few film series have that sort of different dynamic fandom. Because of the different eras.
Have you ever done a list of ones that are technically the best films as opposed to your favourite?
Well, I would say best, favourite, guilty pleasure, because when I've done Catching Bullets, my Bond book, I couldn't really pick a favourite. And I was also highly aware of trying to sell a book where the author says his favourite Bond film is A View to Kill. That's not even now, that would be a little bit of a bold marketing move. So I said, right, I can have favourite, we can also have bests. And that kind of gets around that a bit. But yeah, I mean, yes, you can look at the quality of, I watched You Only Live Twice the other day, there's a sort of Ken Adam centenary tribute. I was just bowled over by the set design. I'd forgotten the set, well, not forgotten it, but I hadn't seen it for a while. Yeah, even just the corridor is beautiful, and the sense of ceiling space and metal.
Well, we've just done a Brosnan episode, or just recorded it, and one of the things that cropped up was, like, Tomorrow Never Dies, we found that very difficult to watch because it just didn't seem like a Bond film that we enjoy, or it didn't seem like a classic Bond film. But for somebody, that's probably the perfect film. They might might tick all the boxes for a really well-made action film.
It's my favourite Pierce Brosnan film.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it often is in my top five, but I don't know why I didn't, actually. Because that's the other thing as well. I'm almost going to put a joke out. Right, now we've done our top five last week. Let's do another one this week, because that's all that's going to happen, because everyone retunes it. But Tomorrow Never Dies is... I like Tomorrow Never Dies. It's got a momentum. And again, it's very much of its time.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of media time, that Britpop, that's Hong Kong and Britain. I love it. I think it's got an energy to it as well a lot of Bond films don't have.
So you'd have that as your top Brosnan?
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of... My least favourite Bond film is The World Is Not Enough. I'll always watch Die Another Day over World Is Not Enough. I just find World Is Not Enough. It's fine. It's still a Bond film, and it's got, you know, great elements. But I find Sophie Marceau really hammy, and she should have been amazing. And I find it pulls its punches. It doesn't have. It won't just have her as the villain. We have to have a reason why a woman is a villain. I find that quite tough. And I was once talking. I was apologising to some people involved in making the film. I said, sorry, I've laid into your film in the book and other places. And they said, no, you were quite right. We deserved it. Which I thought, oh, okay. I like the energy of Tomorrow Never Dies. I like Michelle Yeoh. I think she's a really cool addition to Bond. She's not bimbo-y younger. She's not a trophy Bond girl. She's, you know, literally in the midst with him. I would probably recast Jonathan Pryce, but he was a recast choice over other people that couldn't do it at the last minute.
And I
love the whole Vietnam setting and the whole I'd say Far East, but we don't say that anymore, the whole Asian backdrop to it. I loved it.
Very interesting. We'll have to get you on next week for some more debates.
I will,
over films that we like.
Get me on to defend all the Bond films you don't like. I'll be the
probably got directly opposite lists.
Yes, no, I'm all up for that. Actually, I have seen on some of these photos that have been doing the top five Bond photos have been doing the rounds. Tomorrow Never Dies and Goldeneye comes up a lot. I haven't seen much. I did see A World Is Not Enough today. No one's put Die Another Day yet.
Well, listen, Mark, we watched that find, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm not going to stop with this now until Billie Eilish or Cary Fukunaga do theirs and they put No Time to Die as number one, because the sods have seen it. Because I joked to Barbara Broccoli, I said, don't look at this list, because No Time to Die is number seven. Just as a little quip.
Let's bring it back. Just one last thing we wanted to ask you, Mark, about View to a Kill and the Maud Adams myth, which is something we talked about offline.
Great detail.
So set the record straight. What's the story here?
So Maud Adams should be in every Bond film, admittedly, because I love Maud Adams, and she's my favourite Bond actress, Bond woman, and I'm fortunate to say we know her a bit, and she's shown us around LA a couple of times, and I was in her 4x4, we were driving down Sunset Boulevard, and we'd had lunch, and I was like, the question came up, you know, and I was like, can I ask you, I was a bit tentative, because often when you meet people who are famous for being in a film you love, it's really advisable to not talk about that film too much, but she was fine with it. And I said, were you in A View to a Kill? And she admits, and there's, I think, Good Morning America TV footage at the time. She does turn up at Fisherman's Wharf set to visit Roger Moore. She was in the area. I think she's got a house in San Francisco as well. But she's not in any scene. It was a slight PR myth. I think John Glenn may have pushed it. Maybe she was in it and John Glenn trimmed her out a bit, but she's not in the film. She's not stepping off the tram car. She's not in the beige jacket behind. And she said it's a lovely urban myth.
Incredible. All that time we spent discussing it. Could have just spoken to you.
Well, even on Bond DVD documentaries, don't always believe every story. And also, people don't always remember everything. You know, I don't remember a day's work 20 years ago every time. And even if it's a Bond film, some of these people don't remember every detail.
I actually think when we're on the show, Wheatley, on the podcast, you say there's no truth to this because I can't find any evidence of it. But she does say it on the DVD extras.
I found a lot of articles about this and differing reports of it, and I don't even know where they got some of the information from. But one of them was, it was saying, it was pointing towards one of the ladies in the picture, and it was clearly not her. Like, there was no way it could be her. And they were saying, this is her, that one there on the right. But I don't know how you get to that point. Are these people not, are just ignoring the picture and just assuming... Yeah, that's fine. It's got to be her. Yeah, good. Well, let's put that one to bed then. Don't have to worry about that one anymore.
No, it's definitely not her.
So, Mark, if people want to find you, where do they find you online?
My website's markoconnell.co.uk. Hashtag Catching Bullets or hashtag Watching Skies tends to find me. They're the two sort of books and brands that I straddle. And at the moment, putting top five Bonds, that tends to... bring my name up at the moment. But yeah, I'm out there.
Well, thank you so much for being our very first guest. It's been an absolute honour to have you here.
Who's doing my obituary next week, though? Isn't that how it works?
Well, we don't know what the rule is with guests yet. We know that hosts are okay. We've just got to find out. Well, you'll be the first one to test it.
Yeah, I'm not going out of the house. It's not like some...
That's probably best.
Yes. Anyway, yes. No, it's pleasure, guys. It's always good to talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast. If you want to find us on social media, we're at James Bond A to Z. And if people want to email us...
Podcast at James Bond A to Z. No, it's not that, is it?
It is.
Is it the full one? Podcast at jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
That very slick outing there.
I let it
James Bond will return next time. Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Ciao.
James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Inglemells, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.